Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is off this week. Inauguration Day is less than a month away when President Barack Obama will take the oath of office and begin his second term in the White House. Notwithstanding the looming fiscal cliff and continued political gridlock in Washington, it will be a time for Democrats and many others who support the president to celebrate. It will also be another reminder of what went wrong for Republicans and Mitt Romney in November. The Boston Globe's Michael Cranish has written one of the more complete postmortems of the Romney presidential campaign. It shows how the Obama campaign outmaneuvered Romney on the air and on the ground. It also suggests that the Romney strategy was flawed by Romney's reluctance to tell his own story. Michael Cranish is the co-author of the book The Real Romney. His article about the Romney campaign was published recently in the Boston Globe. And Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's so much interesting stuff in your piece, but let me start with what you describe as Romney's failure to reveal himself and how that really doomed his campaign. And you write that those who knew him best, his wife, Anne, and his son, Tag, wanted Mitt Romney to tell his personal story in a big way. So why didn't that happen?
Well, there was concern by some of the campaign strategists that if they started talking about his personal story, that it would inevitably lead to focus on Romney's Mormon faith, his astounding wealth, and so on. And those were not things that the strategists wanted to focus on. They wanted to focus on jobs and the economy, and Mitt Romney signed off on this strategy. But what that meant was that Mitt Romney had not defined himself in the way that perhaps later on he might have wished he had, because it left an opening for the Obama campaign to fill in some of the gaps.
Now, and I want to talk about that and the way that the Obama campaign did that. But part of Mitt Romney's reluctance or the campaign's reluctance seems like it's rooted in the fact that Mitt Romney is by nature reserved and private. Reserved and private guy, and that can be difficult for a candidate running for public office. And you quote his son, Tag, who says, in fact, his dad was a very reluctant candidate for president from the start.
That's right. Tag said that his father, when thinking about the 2012 race, had no desire to do this and only decided to go ahead when Tag, others, and Mitt's wife, Ann, pushed him to do so and convinced him that there really was no one else who was able to step up and do what needed to be done. So, of course, then at that point, Mitt Romney did decide to run. But, you know, in a lot of ways, the story of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign is the story of a very private man running for the most public job in the country. Mm-hmm. And there is naturally, you know, a clash that occurred there. And part of his agreeing to run for this was that he wasn't going to reveal an awful lot about himself. You know, and there are stories to tell. You know, writing about his life means, obviously, it is focusing partly on his role as a Mormon leader and how he accumulated his wealth. Those are part of his story, but they're not the part of the story that the campaign strategists, you know, saw as key to his winning election.
And you quote David Axelrod, Obama's senior strategist, who regarded this as a gift, and he says, he points out that Romney was reluctant to talk about his faith, reluctant to talk about his business, and reluctant to talk about his governorship here in Massachusetts because of his signature achievement. The health care reform, his health care reform bill just didn't really help him. So how did the Obama campaign exploit that?
Well, they did exploit it quite dramatically. They were waiting for Romney to define himself with ads or other means. And when they saw that he wasn't doing that and there was this opening, what they decided to do was, you know, what might have seemed like a gamble at the time. They took about $65 million in advertising funds that were slated for September and moved them to May and June. And at that time, of course, Romney had just been pummeled in the Republican primaries, been softened up, had spent his money to win the primaries, and didn't have a lot of money to respond. And the Obama campaign, you know, then put on a pretty sophisticated and negative advertising campaign to really tear down Romney as much as possible and weaken him further. And there were those in the Romney campaign, I quote one of them, as saying they saw these ads running, but it wasn't a huge national campaign that was going to be obvious. Some of it was a little bit under the radar from a national perspective. There were ads running in this suburb or that suburb, you know, looking after key constituencies, women voters on certain issues. But, you know, bit by bit, the money was flowing, and it certainly had an impact that we can now see as the campaign is over, you know, where that landed some serious blows against Romney.
And the blows that he never really recovered from. You also write just how the Obama campaign outgunned and outmaneuvered the Romney campaign on the ground, and you have some great numbers in there. Nationwide, Obama had 3,000 staff members versus 500 for Romney. And then if you look in these battleground states, in Florida, 770 staff members versus 200, and in Ohio, Obama had 123 field offices versus 40 for Romney in Ohio. Why did the Romney campaign let this imbalance on the ground occur?
Well, it really was a striking imbalance. And early on in my reporting, one of Romney's closest advisors did say that, look, you know, Obama had more people in Florida than we had in the country. And then if you extrapolate from there, you can see where the problems come from. The reason for this is a different two things. Number one, as the Romney people point out, Barack Obama did not have to spend money to win the primaries. Mitt Romney had to spend more than $100 million to win the primaries. But Obama was spending a lot of money. What was he spending the money on? Paying for staff and offices in places that they knew would be battleground states. So it was certainly fair on the part of the Romney people to look and point out and say, you know, the Obama people had this great advantage going in. They didn't have to fight in the primaries. They could spend that money knowing that they'd be spending it for the general and almost certain that Romney would be the nominee, despite the ferocious fight going on in the Republican Party at that time.
Sure. You also describe an impressive technological advantage that the Obama folks had over Romney. A case in point, this computer-assisted system that allowed the campaign to identify and reach voters. It worked flawlessly on Election Day for the Obama camp, while the Romney campaign sort of had its own system that actually crashed on election night. How serious was that?
Well, this was a program called Orca, and I wrote a story about this a couple of days after Election Day where I talked about how this program that was ballyhooed by Romney himself, a state-of-the-art technology, the Romney folks said the Obama people had nothing like it, and then lo and behold, on Election Day, at TD Garden in Boston, there were 800 Romney workers, and they were supposed to field data from about 30,000 volunteers across the country at key polling places who would basically indicate who had voted and who had not, and they'd match that up against lists to get out people if they were expected to have voted. So it was touted to be a very sophisticated program. The problem is that they had not tested this rigorously in an Election Day type scenario. They had not tested it in TD Garden, and lo and behold, on Election Day, the entire system crashed, went down for hours, and it created pretty much a wave of panic at TD Garden. The Obama people, ironically, had a similar system in 2008. It, too, had crashed in 08, and so they worked for months to test this in sort of battleground conditions. And when they had their new version of their program, it did work flawlessly, and Romney's crashed. So the Romney folks say in the end that this wasn't determinative, quote-unquote, in the election, but clearly it was a letdown for thousands of volunteers and has become sort of a symbol of what went wrong with the Romney campaign.
Mm. Well, you also mention these exit polls that told a sort of stunning story about this election. A majority of voters preferred Romney's vision, values, and leadership, you write, but Obama overwhelmed Romney with the question, which candidate cares about people like me, 81 to 18%. Is it your view that, you know, had the Romney people done the ground game differently, fought the ad wars differently, got their computerized voter tracking system down so that it worked, that they might have actually been able to win?
Well, there's always a lot of factors in an election. It's not just one thing, but there were a number of things. They made some strategic decisions. And in talking to me, I think pretty openly, the entire story is on the record quotes. No one's bashing someone else anonymously. I think what they're trying to do is say, look, here's where we made a mistake. Here's what should be done differently. Mitt Romney himself is going to talk with the Republican National Committee, and they're having an investigation here in Washington, where I'm talking to you from, where they're going to talk to hundreds of people and try to figure out what went wrong, to reverse engineer the Romney failure. And, you know, Romney himself is part of that, his staff is part of that, but also, you know, there are a lot of general conditions that the Republican Party itself is responsible for, all sorts of things we could talk about outside the Romney campaign. So there's just a whole host of reasons. And yes, I mean, the bottom line was on election day, there were some pretty striking results there. They had not, for whatever reason, part of it's the infamous 47% video in which Romney made his comments, we're all familiar with. So there are a number of things that went wrong. You know, each one of them is a piece of the puzzle in understanding why Romney lost the race.
Well, you certainly provided a lot of the pieces of the puzzle in this piece. Michael Cranish, thanks so much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Michael Cranish. He's deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. He's also co-author, along with Scott Hellman, of The Real Romney. And you can find a link to his piece on Romney's failed presidential bid at radioboston.org. Well, much of the region had a bit of a white Christmas yesterday, but tonight some parts of Massachusetts might end up with a lot more snow. And joining us now for the latest on the incoming storm is meteorologist Mark Rosenthal. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Happy holidays
Excellent.
To you. So when is the snow likely to start, and how much can we expect?
Well, it's already snowing in New York City, so we do a little extrapolation here. So we say by 7, 8 o'clock tonight should be snowing lightly in Boston. The city will probably get about an inch or two of snow and then go to rain. But the main forecast, you know, concern for me is the 128 to 495 belt where snow late tonight will be going over to sleet and freezing rain.
I see. So that'll be happening late tonight. And what about the biggest snow accumulation? Where is that going to be happening in the region?
Well, probably north and west of Nashua, New Hampshire. We're thinking probably, 1 to 2 inches of snow here in Boston when you get out to Worcester County, 4 to 8 inches, southern New Hampshire, 5 to 10. But then they're going to get a major ice storm from Worcester County up to southern New Hampshire. And once you get up into the Concord area, Portland, Maine, up in the Lakes region, good chunk of Vermont, they're probably going to see over a foot of snow.
Mm, so that makes for a challenging commute around the cities, but maybe some much-needed white stuff in ski country, it sounds like.
Exactly. You know, tomorrow morning the ride into work is not going to be fun. It'll just be raining here in Boston. But it's interesting to me. We may actually get what we call a dry slot coming up with dry air punching in from the Boston area point south. So the heaviest rain could shut off in Boston before midday while they're continuing to get a blizzard up across northern New England.
All right. And Mark, finally, how about a preview of the New Year's weekend weather? What does it look like?
Well, we think an Arctic cold front is going to be coming in here New Year's Eve, perhaps with flurries or snow squalls, and New Year's Day is going to be brutally cold, partly sunny, windy, temperatures 15 to 20, wind chills down in the single numbers.
Well, that's meteorologist Mark Rosenthal. Mark, thanks so much for the update.
Sure, thank you.
And stay with us. Up next, the untold story of Louisa May Alcott, the celebrated author of Little Women and the powerful influence of her mother. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.